Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, to the beginning of March. We're certainly in the Big 12 March, and I know I've got a couple of emails from people in retrospect to my newsletter. And yes, officially we will be in the vernal equinox as of March. Actually, they say it's the 19th, but it's kind of really the 20th. So right around the corner. Besides of all the wonderful things that go on with March, and people are certainly ready to run outside if they haven't kind of already. It's all these other wonderful things that kind of like go on with March. Besides the fact that it's equinox of time, maybe you want to start beginning things in your life. And there's a whole thing about navigating of seasons, which is interesting that I wrote about in my newsletter, my March newsletter. And I was looking through my quotes of my guest tonight. And then I was like, I'm looking at it, and I keep saying, like, navigating seasons of grief. And I was thinking, yeah, but we're definitely in the right season for what we're going to be sort of like talking about tonight. But just on a real quick scale here, the number to call, if anybody wants to call and have questions, we're more than happy. I am, and my guest as well, 347-945-7785. That's 347-945-7785, and we'd be real happy and always be as patient as we have, because people, they call in and then they kind of like we get sort of like a line. So I like to try to keep everybody lined up and kind of in the order that they sort of like come in, and sometimes we jump that, but in any case, that is definitely the number, 347, and keep that in mind for all of them. Because that will be the number that you will definitely call in and sort of check it out. So I'm just going to give everybody that number real quick again. It's 347-945-7785. By the way, I know I got some emails from everybody last month. Actually, my guest was supposed to have been on our show last month, and I think we had sent out letters and certainly some quotes right kind of afterwards that we did have a little bit of an issue, and actually I was sort of the issue, and I actually caught you real quick right before the show, and Claudia was more than gracious to say she'd come back again to this month. But now that I'm looking at it about the season thing, I think maybe March might have even kind of like worked out really, really well here. So the book I want to talk about, which is kind of like perfect for the season, but it's not like perfect for the season, but it's kind of like perfect for where we are, because the name of the book is called Seasons of Grief, and it's a wonderful book that has so much information for anybody out there that's going through any level, any phase, any where you've been, how long you've been, about how you can make the reflectiveness of you and your process. And what's nice, what is Seasons of Grief, because literally it is about the seasons of grief. And I know one of the things we talk about is autumn and going into winter, and winter can be sometimes really, really hard for people that are in grief, because, winter is, it can be cold and can be quiet and can be by yourself and all other things. But besides a lot of the obvious wonderful things is that there's a lot of exercises and guides that can help everybody sort of through this. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce my guest, who is a grief counselor, and she's author, by the way, of several different books we'll talk about, and some of them are the toolkits working with grief, which also is accentuated in this book of the seasons of it. But she does these exercises, these easy exercises to activate and navigate through all the ebb and the flows of the seasons. And so her latest book is called Seasons of Grief, Creative Interventions to Support Bereaved People. And this is Claudia Conan, and welcome to the show, Claudia.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Suzanne.
You're welcome. And I'm gonna preface one other thing here, is that her website, which, by the way, I'm going to spell it out to you, is called the Karuna Project, and it's .com. And I promised Claudia that I would ask her as we go forth, because that is her website, and obviously that's reflective of her work and her books and everything that she's been doing, and compassionately, I will say, in terms of creative counseling for people that are grieving. So thus the name, Claudia.
The KarunaProject.com. So the word Karuna is a Sanskrit word that means compassion, and it refers to an active compassion. And I came upon the word because my my husband, the father of my children, wrote that on every letter that he wrote. He put it up where you're supposed to put the date. He put this word Karuna. And he died in 2005, and I sort of was rummaging through trying to find if he kept journals, trying to sort of – it was almost as if I was looking for him, you know. But what I found were these letters with this word, which was a reminder to me that, you know, that that's a word that he wrote. And we didn't know what it meant, and we looked it up, and it means this act of compassion. And I talked it over with my children, and we decided that he was one of the most compassionate people that we knew. And so the word was very meaningful to us in reference to him. And I decided at that time, even though I didn't know what I would do going forward with my life, I decided that anything that I did going forward would be called the Karuna Project in honor of him. And my children had the word tattooed on them, so they all got that tattooed. So I call my work the Karuna Project, and I have developed something called the Karuna Cards, which are prompts for grief and processing for difficult life transitions. And it's just very meaningful. It kind of brings him forward, even though he's been gone for a long time. It sort of keeps him very present in the work that I do. So that's why I use that word. And it's K-A-R-U-N-A.
Yeah, it's a pretty powerful word. You can actually sort of see it in the sound. And generally words like this that have a lot of vowels in them really, you know, really resonate. So before we go kind of further, and, you know, I'm talking about, you know, obviously because you do have three books you got. And now, was your first book, just jumping forward here, Shattered by Grief, was that upon the crossing of
yeah.
of your husband? That's not, yes. Okay.
Is that
what kind of led you in this direction, or is this something you were kind of had passion for prior?
No, when he died, I grew up in the performing arts as a child and a teenager. I was a musician with my family, and I also always danced, and I always was creating dances, and I always wrote in journals and wrote poetry and dabbled in all kinds of different types of craft, like quilting and embroidery. The one thing I didn't do was draw, because I really thought I couldn't draw. But I would engage with a lot of different types of creative process. So when my husband Albie died, I just, for my own process, went immediately to using all of the things that I knew, which were to move, to write, to scribble, to embroider, just anything that I could do, collage, to help myself with all of these really strong emotions and the feeling that I had been shattered and broken by his death. And while I was doing that, I thought that maybe there would be a way to help other people, because I was suddenly tuned in to how difficult such a dramatic death was, because I really felt like my personality was shattered. So I decided that I wanted to become a creative grief counselor. And I was in my early 50s, and so I didn't want to learn all the things that a social worker needs to know or a therapist needs to know with all of the, you know, supervised hours. I just wanted to learn about grief. So I set out to figure out a way to do that, and I got a master's degree in transpersonal psychology with an emphasis on creativity and innovation, which was aligned to my creative life. And then I also went to Brooklyn College for a grief counseling certificate, and then I was advised to become certified with the Association for Death Education and Counseling, and then I began working in the field. At that time, when I started working in a hospice, I actually stopped journaling. So the idea of writing a book was not on my radar until I lost my job. And then I went back and mined my journals and put together what I had learned in my grief counseling studies and also in the work that I had done in hospice for almost 4 years to write Shattered by Grief, picking up the pieces to become whole again. Because when he died, I had this compulsion. I felt broken and I wanted to feel whole again. After about 5 or 6 years, I kind of got to a place where I realized I had never completely been broken. It just felt that way. But that's sort of what grief does to us. So that's the first book. The first book has a bit of memoir, my story of him and our life together, and then it also has some anecdotes from the clients that I worked with in hospice, and then I use the word whole as chapter headings, whole. So what happened, who am I, help, how do I do this, opening up to emotion, learning to live fully again after loss, and then exploring the past to experience the future. So that's the word whole. And so there are creative exercises in that book as well.
So when you also talk about in the Seasons of Grief is that, you know, I love the idea of the you know, coming from being an artist and a poet. And just one of my thoughts about that is that actually that was my background before I started doing what I did, mm-hmm. although this is all I've ever done my whole life. But my background was music and obviously, you know, composition. And so I remember very vividly, you know, as I wrote, I kept saying, like, you know, what does a normal, what do most people do when they're going through, you know, whatever they're in their life, you know, whether it be grief or struggles or whichever, and they don't have an outlet for it. They don't have, you know, they can't go play the piano maybe, or they can't go do like you did, dance and do all those other things. And I always remember that being such a strong, you know, thought for me. And then, of course, you know, down the road, ended up doing, you know, what I did or what I do, how somehow that shifted. But in your poem stuff and as an artist, it says that, and I don't know if this is something that came out of, you know, that you did from the Seasons of Grief or it was part of all your process of doing the grief, when you talk about the 17 heart-centered therapies. And so are they all part of these? Or is this part of the book? Or is that broken down in terms of some of the, you know, the aspects that you talk about in terms of the book of how, you know, it's broke down in different areas? Because I know you mentioned, you know, the poems of Dr. Neil Meyer, I think his name is, and different aspects. So it sounds like that was all part of your heart center and the grief and the compassion of how, what obviously what's involved in terms of bereavement therapy and all of that kind of that goes with it.
Right. So one of the things, one of the bases for this book is that because of the pandemic, we couldn't meet. We had virtual conferences. All of my colleagues were, you know, maybe I could talk to them on the phone or Zoom with them, but we were not able to be together as we all experienced. And so I decided that I wanted to invite colleagues to write. So the 17 heart-centered parts of this book are actually 17 contributors in addition to myself. And so I invited, first I had a conversation with Dr. Robert Niemeyer, who's one of the foremost grief therapists and researchers in the world. And I sort of ran this idea by him. What do you think of, you know, inviting people to write for this and maybe framing it through the life cycle of nature and maybe the seasons? And he said that would be a great idea. And then I asked him if he could send me one of his poems, and he sent me 27 poems, which I chose three. But he also framed each season with a couple of words. So autumn is letting go. Autumn is letting go. Winter is in stillness. Spring is awakening, and summer is in fullness. So the book is structured through the seasons, and it begins with autumn, and then it has a poem, and then it has some art by a friend of mine, a really amazing artist, Deborah Kopp-Chapin, who does a process called touch drawing, which is a very deep process. So her art is in there because I wanted the book to feel creative, not just to offer creative techniques. And then it goes through several art therapists, a music thanatologist. There is a nature therapist in England, Louise Allen, and she wrote a chapter for each season. And she takes her clients out to the beach where they gather stones, or she takes them into the woods where they look at the patterns made by nature and they create their own hieroglyphics and do sort of very creative symbolic journaling. She wrote four chapters. Some people wrote one chapter, some people wrote two. There's one woman who wrote a chapter on using film for grief, and also celebrating ancestral loss, navigating people through objects of family loss and the transgenerational experience. So there's a very broad amount of offerings within this book. There's a couple of interviews, a couple of interview chapters. A colleague of mine who's a playwright interviewed different artists about how they use their different types of art for their own personal grief. And that's her premise is out of grief comes art. So I have a chapter in there on the rings of identity, sort of exploring the multiplicity of ourselves inside and how to integrate. So that's why there's 17, there's all these different people in this book. I'm the editor and sort of the weaver of the book. It's a very rich, it's really quite rich.
That's really sweet.
I'm very pleased with it.
I know you know this, and so I will mention this because this is something that I speak about a lot in terms of, you know, my work and connecting and obviously connecting people that, you know, want to be open to the, you know, option to connecting to their loved ones that have crossed over. So, obviously people don't know it, but I met you at Omega, where I was doing an evening after this group of intense, from everything I understand, that did this workshop with Terry Daniel, and people know her from my show. But what I talked about, and I don't know if I talked about it that night before I gave my messages or not, because I never know what I sort of say, but one of the things that I have always felt so strong about and what I love about places like Omega and like what you're talking about in terms of aspects of seasons of grief is this element of nature and how, you know, by walking through the woods and being in the trees and being in all of that, not only is it, as you say, an unbelievable connective way of dealing with your grief, but to me, the one step farther for people that, you know, are open to it and certainly in circumstances, because that's, you know, what part of the, I understand part of the weekend was about, was being receptive to that, is that that's a wonderful place where we can hear messages from our loved ones. And if you're focusing on, like you said, these heart centers, and you find yourself in the woods in this nature, and you open your heart and your mind and your senses to listening, you just might get a message. And some people obviously are more attuned, and it's easier for them than others. But it sounds to me, when you're talking about, you know, all this creative, you know, elements between, you know, poetry and journaling and like that, those are, to me, all the ways that we go ahead and we open up this door. And
I agree. So I agree. I think, I think creativity it opens up all of these different aspects that it opens up our awareness and allows us to gather more insight into our process and into the connections that we still have with the people that are no longer with us, because those connections are very strong. And, you know, a lot of my clients come in, you know, in my grief counseling practice, and a lot of the time we talk, you know, that is what we do. But whenever they present a metaphor, I might almost intuitively give them paper and ask them to draw the metaphor, or we might do a collage, or we might, you know, take out stones and imbue them with symbolism and move them around. And it just opens up another level of depth to working through your grief. And the other thing about this, and it was Louise Allen in England who wrote me this long email about the life cycles of nature and how a plant grows. It, you know, it bursts up from the ground, and then it, you know, it becomes into its full growth, and then it dies and it disintegrates and it becomes, you know, food for a nutrient in the soil. And that is, you know, that's the life cycle of nature, and then it all circles around. And our lives have that kind of cycling in it as well. And when somebody dies and our lives are really strongly affected, you know, we do have to find ways to pick up the pieces, to grow from the experience and to sort of rekindle our life and find ways to bring them with us if we can, in terms of connection. So that's all part of the grief work. And I'm particularly focused now on how we live in the long term after someone has died. I lost my second husband 16 months ago, and, you know, that has, you know, kind of rocked my world again. And, you know, so I'm very focused on resilience and strength and creativity and how all of those things can help us in these times of transition.
Wow. That's interesting. We're going to take a quick break. And again, my guest is Claudia Kooning, and we definitely want to emphasize very, very much. And I want to talk a little bit about how you became a thanatologist, which, by the way, a lot of people who do grief work are not thanatologists, and you are one of those. But we're going to talk about the Karuna more, and we're going to give you a website out again on how you can connect to I'll do a spelling for everybody exactly, because all this stuff, by the way, is always on my website, everybody, and if you sort of like tune to the show. Again, this is Suzanne Elton with my special guest, Claudia Kooning, and we're just going to take a quick break.
This is Suzanne's website, www.suzannenorthrup.com, for all the latest news, calendar, and for any events. You can also sign up for her newsletter at www.suzannenorthrup.com. That's SUZANENORTHROP.
Welcome back with Suzanne and Claudia. I just want to made myself think about something here. And again, the number to call in, guys, is 347-945-7785. Is that I kind of knew the word thanatology, but I really never explored it or knew exactly what it kind of meant. And I got involved with it, not really involved with it, but what I really learned about it was, and I'm sure you remember when 2012 came, that was like a big year for a lot of people, and there was, there were all kinds of things going on kind of all over the world in terms of, like, what was going to happen. It was a big deal and stuff. But anyway, I was invited to a conference in Mexico, and somehow they found me, and they were honoring me as a medium that had been doing this work for a really, really, really long time. And part of the people that, I guess, I don't think sponsored it or somewhat connected to it were thanatologists. And that was, like I said, really the first time I'd heard that on this kind of sort of level. And to be part of this, this wonderful ceremonial thing, which, of course, was quite incredible because it went on, like, all night until the morning and whatever. But it was pretty, pretty cool. But I noticed that you have worked, that you're also been a fellow thanatologist. And so I don't know if you that got combined with Claudia, with you doing your grief work, or you decided to do that as part of your grief counseling, or how did that sort of come up? Because obviously that's what thanatology is. My understanding what it is about is dealing with a certain amount of grief.
Thanatology. The definition of thanatology is the study of death, dying, and bereavement. So when I went to Brooklyn College, the head of the program, Dr. David Balk, told me that I could take this advanced grief counseling certificate, but that I had to join the Association for Death Education and Counseling, and I had to be certified in thanatology. And what he was doing was encouraging me to learn as much as I could about death, dying, and bereavement. And that actually is aligned with who I am. When I'm interested in something, I want to learn as much as I possibly can. And when I was about 12, I really wanted to learn about mythology. And my grandfather gave me Bullfinch's mythology. And the reason that the word thanatology exists is because it comes from a demigod, Thanatos, who with his brother Hypnos ensured a calm and peaceful death. They're such minor gods that they're actually not in my Bullfinch's mythology, but that's where the word comes from. So I was at the time when I was completing my grief counseling certificate at Brooklyn College and finishing up my master's, I applied and took the exam to be certified in thanatology. And then I was recertified a couple of times. And then if you continue to learn and grow and present workshops and write books and other things that you do in the field, then you can apply and take the exam to become a fellow in thanatology. So I was just recertified as a fellow in thanatology. But what it means is that I've done the study and I've really continue to learn. I just got another certification with Dr. Niemeyer's Portland Institute for Loss and Transition, and that is grief therapy as meaning reconstruction. So I'm always wanting to learn. But you're right. There are a lot of people who work with grief, but they're not thanatologists. That doesn't necessarily mean that they don't know and they haven't studied, but having this kind of certification indicates that I have done the advanced study.
Yeah. Like I said, it was really interesting for me, and I would have said, if I was a little more of an English-speaking country as opposed to being in Mexico. and of course, obviously people spoke English, but there was a lot of people there. I'm trying to remember the Japanese man who had done a lot of forms of healing on areas that had been like let's say they had been poisoned by something, or either by a fungus or a growth or something, and he would be working with the actual water in that area, and he was quite amazing. He died a few years back, and I've got a couple of his books, but he was there also, and he talked about that process of how that when something was poisoned, how one goes through a whole way of altering that energy, and there's a way you can alter that energy. And his particular specialty was dealing with water that had, for some reason had gotten poisoned either through, because a lot of times when they don't have, water doesn't move, it goes bad. And he had been known to do this, and he had done also some really wonderful work with children that had needed different interventions in relationship to that. But it was kind of a really interesting conference to meet him, who spoke absolutely no English whatsoever, and sort of all these other people from they sort of came from all over the world, because like I said, it was this big thing in 212, and apparently where they gave the conference in Mexico, and I couldn't tell you where they took me. I'll be honest with you. Was supposed to be a peak of, because they always talk about vortexes, and vortexes, how they're very prominent in certain areas, and that's where this took place. And like I said, it was a whole big thing about 2012. So it was really kind of interesting, like I said, and to learn about thanatology. I felt like, of all the years that I had done this work, that was really the first time that I'd heard about that. So when I read that under your quote-unquote bio, I thought, oh, this is cool, because I kind of see them going together. I mean, I don't kind of see how you would do one without the other, but I guess that's just probably my own purpose on, and some people deal with grief and bereavement, kind of very differently, but it is death. I mean,
I think, a lot of the popular culture has sort of just glommed on to the five stages of grief, which were Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's sort of original way of looking at she was actually working with dying people, and she at the time when people the doctors didn't tell them that they were dying, so they could feel it, but they were not being given the information. And she started to just talk to them honestly and say, what are you feeling? What do you think is happening? And they would often say, I feel like I'm dying, but please don't tell my loved ones because that will make them upset. And then when she would talk to the family,
correct,
the family would say the
yes,
same thing: please don't tell him because he'll give up. But what she did is she identified sort of themes or commonalities with the people that she talked to, and she wrote books about them. And when you write a book, it's a linear thing. People tend to open it at the beginning and they go to the end. And so her work got completely misinterpreted as if this was how you do it. This is the way that you do grief, and there's five stages, and then you bing, bang, boom, and you're done. And that's not how it is. And she never
that's
said
that
it
true.
Was. It's
no,
not true.
No,
but she actually is like the grandmother of being able to talk about this stuff. And, of course, since she put forward her five stages, she wrote a lot of other books, and she wrote books about, the afterlife and other things that she was actually quite vilified for that in the medical community. But there's been so much research on meaning making and benefit finding and the dual process model of grief and companioning your client through grief, walking beside them. There's so many different ways, and I like to apply as many different ways as I can to whatever suits the situation or whatever's walking into the office. So the client might come in, and it might seem that using the dual process makes sense. And then that same client might come in the week after, and we're going to talk about something else or pull out a different model. But so I try to be very responsive to meet them where they are when they come in and have a big toolkit of my own. So it's quite interesting. And I think that there are a lot of people who say that they do work with grief, but they're in therapy programs and in nursing school, medical programs. They really don't teach very much about it at all. Now that doesn't mean that you can't go out and learn, because there's dozens and hundreds of books that you can read and conferences and classes that you can take. You know, the ADEC conference is a great place. Portland Institute for Loss and Transition is a wonderful place to take classes. And there's a lot of information out there that can help people learn more about grief.
Right. Well, you know, Terry lives in Portland, so I'm sure she's kind of hooked up to that. But it's interesting.
Oh,
you
she is very much. Yes.
Yeah, she is. She actually lives in Portland, so and you know, she does what she does. You know, as well, she's a she works a lot, does a lot of hospice work. But I have to say that I feel quite privileged, because I got to do an HBO special with Elizabeth and got to meet her. And to say that she was a hoot is kind of an understatement.
So that's marvelous. I recently did a cable show with her son, Ken Ross. And that was a pleasure to meet him. And we spent the afternoon and the evening together, because all of us that were, this was on Open to Hope TV, and the Open to Hope Foundation is another wonderful grief foundation that has a lot of information and podcasts, and they do a lot of things. But Ken and I were on that show, and we all went out to dinner afterwards. So I got to spend a lot of time with him and talk to him, get to know him.
That's really cool. Well, you know, she, like I said, she was not only a pioneer, but she went through some very, very intense stuff about, you know, where she was living when she was dealing with, you know, AIDS babies. And she really, she went through some, definitely sort of like hell in her life. And I think one of my favorite quotes, and I'm almost positive she did this, and she wrote this, or she said this in the movie, in the there's a documentary called Life After Life. And she was asked the question about, you know, I don't know how they phrased it to her, but something about, you know, that, you know, you weren't supposed to talk to dead people or something to that effect. And her words, pretty much verbatim, were, "Oh, poppycock. Who do you think's been dead longer than anybody else that everybody talked to?" Which is Jesus. I mean, you could see her saying that. It was like, that. Those are her words. I mean, I cracked up. I mean, I just cracked up. And like I said, you know, here she's like this saying, like, you know, you're not supposed to talk to dead people. Well, people have been talking to Jesus for a long time. And it was one of those moments you had to be there. But it actually, I actually got in the documentary. I can't believe that they didn't edit out, that they left her, you know where she was,
mm-hmm.
which is really, really quite interesting. So, I thought the fact that you got to meet her son, I think was probably, you know, really quite interesting. Really quite interesting. So that was kind of a moment for you as well.
Yes,
so,
I mean he's running the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross Foundation around the world, and he travels, and they're putting hospices in prisons and in very poor countries, and you know he's continuing her work.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. See, that was something that I didn't know. I mean, I knew that she had a son, but that was something that I didn't know. But she definitely was a pioneer, and she definitely did set up the stages. And you know, when people talked about them in the level of being restriction, but actually they're not, because there is a process to stages, and it doesn't, you may use different words for, you know, from the moments that you go through, because you know, once you, as I don't have to tell you from going through this personally in your life, is that, you know, once there's a reality that you wake up that one day, like, oh, you know, this person's body is not going to be around, you know, whether you believe they're going to be around, but the way we know the relationship is no longer going to be around, and you know, and what we do with that. So, but in any case,
right.
She definitely was one, and you're right, because I don't have to tell you, because I know you know this, is that it's always amazement to me, as long as I've been doing this work, which is a really long time, is how uncomfortable people are about talking about death, number one, and number two, that not only is it not talked about, but it's sort of like put into the corner, like we should not talk about it, which all it does is create a whole different levels of pain and not dealing with something that we're all in some point in our life going to deal with. It's interesting because I used to think that the number one fear was snakes, but I learned it was death.
Yeah, I mean,
snakes is on the top of my list.
I would really hope that the pandemic awakened people a lot more to grief and loss, because we lost so much. During the pandemic, we were losing, you know, our ability to connect with people, to live our lives in a normal way. And then there was so much illness and death all around us, and we couldn't have the regular rituals. We couldn't be with our loved ones when they were ill. And, you know, I participated with about almost 100 other colleagues in trying to brainstorm how to create a resource guide for people in the beginning of the pandemic. And we ended up producing something called the COVID paper, which was this very big compendium of, you know, what grief was like, how to approach it during this very strange time, and then there's like pages and pages of resources for every different type of situation, for children, for adults, for, you know, funerals, how to conduct Zoom funerals, and organizations that did that. And it was actually adopted by several states as a guide for their mental health their mental health departments. So, you know, we started that in March of 2020. We just jumped right into it. It was organized by Michael Hebb. So I think that people are talking about it more. I know that all of my colleagues are really trying to bring it to the front. My colleague, Elizabeth Copeland, who wrote the chapter Out of Grief Comes Art, she has a foundation called The Grief Dialogues, and she produces short plays about death, dying, and bereavement. And then there's a facilitated conversation about that that happens afterwards with the audience. And she just recently had a play produced on off-Broadway called Till Death, which was a look at a family as the mom, mother, and grandmother was dying, and all the different things that came up in the family dynamics. And there again, she also had several after talks, and Ken Ross did one, and I did another, talking about anticipatory grief and grieving through the holidays. So we're all out there working and trying to get people to talk about it because we do need to talk about it.
That's great. Well, I can attest that during the pandemic, I never worked so hard. That's all I can tell you. I mean, I literally had one family in the room and the other family talking to a nurse in the hospital while literally their dad was dying or their husband. I mean, it was and so that they wouldn't be alone. And I think with the medical people, you know, particularly the nurses, the stuff that they did was amazing stuff. And the stuff that they went through in the process of that, I thought was just really, you know, just outrageous, because they were the only connectors that could actually be with the people when they were dying, and have presence of being able to connect with the families on the other end of the lines or the phones or you know, however we were doing it. I mean, I was doing Zooms with them, so it was really, I mean, for me it was really kind of really, really interesting. And I think for me the other interesting part about it is that because the families couldn't be together, I was able to have one in Ireland and one in Chicago and one in Florida, all on the line at the same time, connecting. It was the only way that they could sort of connect with each other after they, because a lot of it, I dealt with so many people that lost people during that time. So
exactly.
It was a real, for me, a whole, kind of a whole interesting world of what I do. And quite some wonderful, wonderful, beautiful moments about it. Really, really wonderful moments. And you are right, is that it was in everybody's face. So people were forced in a way that they normally wouldn't be.
Because right, and I think it has generated more conversation.
Dying.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I have to say, you know, the Barbie movie, which where Barbie the doll starts having existential fear of death. I mean, a billion people watched that movie, and that's what they were talking about. Now, did they talk about grief? No, not so much. But at least it was on the radar. And I thought that was a really great thing. So it was but it was really great.
Yes, that's great. That's great. Yes. So you know what it is? You never know what it is that's going to come up that we're going to talk about, or how it's going to come up, or what viewfinder it's going to be under, and, you know, so that's sort of that. So, again, my special guest is Claudia Conan, and we want to talk quite literally, about the Corona Project.com.
Karuna.
So, but it's spelled T-H-E-K-A-R-U-N-A Project.com. And like I said,
that's my website.
Claudia's website. Again, if you miss it, you can of course always go to my webpage and catch it out from there. And think about a couple other things you might want to talk about in relationship to your, you know, to your wonderful book, Seasons of Grief. And we're going to take another quick break, and we'll be back in a moment.
This is Suzanne's website, www.suzannenorthrup.com, for all the latest news, calendar, and for any events. You can also sign up for her newsletter at www.suzannenorthrup.com. That's SUZANENORTHROP.
Welcome back with Suzanne and Claudia, and I'm just going to give a couple quick announcements here. For me, for the month of March, I've got one small group on the 11th, and that's my usual limited to 5 people, and it's usually 6 to 7:30, somewhere in there. But I am actually going to do my own gallery this month, although next month I'm going to be doing one with Cheryl Murphy, and then in May I'll be doing one with Thomas John. But this month I'm actually going to do the open gallery with this kind of like, you know, not limited to people, and that's going to be on the 21st of March. And, of course, all this stuff is on my site, which is www.suzannenorthrup.com. Even if you misspell my name, you will find me. I'm definitely floating around in the cosmos, as they say. And, again, the number to call is 347-945-7785. We do have a caller. I'm just going to open the line to her and see if she does have a question to Claudia, because I would prefer that for this evening as opposed to message. But let's just see if she's on the line here.
Hey, good evening. Apologies. I just want to ask a personal question. I don't know if you need a question relating to the show.
Well, I would like to. I'd like to open up the lines if you have any questions to Claudia as my guest for the evening. And I'm sure if you have a question for me, it may be sort of to the side to Claudia.
Wonderful. Okay.
So that would be great.
I'm just wondering what you see as the future with my relationship with my granddaughter. Something just happened again today that broke my heart regarding the parents, and just trying to prepare myself and figure out what I need to do.
Well, I'm not so sure that that's the kind of answers or questions that, you know, that certainly, you know, Claudia would be answering. Unless you want to jump in, Claudia, that's totally on you.
Nope.
What I will sort of say to you is this. Just real quickly, and I don't know why, sometimes, how do I say this? Sometimes helping could be great. Sometimes it can collude things, and I don't know why I want to say it. So you're talking about your granddaughter in relationship to her parents, and that's
I mean, will I be seeing my granddaughter, or is there going to be a period where it's have a relationship with her?
Okay, I got it. I'm going to say there may be some periods, there may be some rough roads. But I somehow think as long as you are solid and you walk the road kind of how you know you have to walk the road, I think you'll work your way through.
Okay.
That I believe. And I do think that this little girl is very attached to you, and I think that's a plus in your area.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't want to.
Oh, no problem here. No problem. Just breathe a lot.
Yeah. Well, you know what? My working from my heart means not having a relationship with her.
I understand totally. We know that program all too well. All too well.
That's great. Okay.
So
thank you. God bless you both.
All right. You're welcome. Okay. I never know, because sometimes people call toward the end and whatever it is, but I always like to give the option, because I never know, you know, how some of the things you've spoken about would be, you know, a real kind of a plus to somebody else here. So I know we've covered a lot of different areas, and I know you've talked about a lot of different people that are in relationship with your book. But let's just mention a couple of the other books. You got the Karuna Cards, and your first book was called Shattered by Grief. And then you have a separate book that's called The Creative Toolkit for working with grief and bereavement. And so I'm sure that some of these overlap, but give me sort of a feel of some of the other ones we got going here.
Right. So I talked about Shattered by Grief, picking up the pieces to become whole again. The Karuna cards were developed because I was suggesting journaling to people, and when I was working in hospice, and people said they didn't know where to start. So I just developed originally a set of prompts for journaling, but they expanded to be walking in nature, envisioning the future, doing a lot of different things. So there's 52 cards in the Karuna deck, and they can be shuffled, and you can choose a card, and if you don't like it, you can pick a different one, because it's a random choice. The Creative Toolkit for Working with Grief and Bereavement, a practitioner's guide, that came out of the conversations that we were having at the Association for Death Education and Counseling about why grief was not taught in medical programs and in psychotherapy programs. And so I decided to write sort of a compendium of grief theory, which is the first part of the book, which starts with Kubler-Ross and goes through a lot of different models that I have been exposed to and that I like, and also talks about my own view of creativity. And then the second part of the book are 30 worksheets that can be photocopied and used. And they're very accessible. The book is written towards practitioners, so it tends to give the instructions by saying, advise your client to do this. But you can take that word out, and it can be used by anybody. There's lots of different diagrams and somatic suggestions and things that you can do in that book. So that's the Creative Toolkit. And I'm it's been fun writing books and being published. My publisher is Jessica
that's
Kingsley.
Great. Well, you like being creative, so this is kind of right up your line, right? You know,
I do.
Yeah. So. You know, it's like they say, like, not one thing fits all. We know that philosophy. But out of all the work you've done with all the different people that you've done and all the different types of, you know, of therapies and from thanatology to, you know, as a grief counselor, as a woman who lost, you know, two important relationships in her life, what would you say that tends to be the most significant? If you could narrow it down to one or two different things, in terms of your work, of what seems to be the most powerfully helpful to people,
I think it all comes back to the concept of Karuna, of compassion, and it's sitting in compassionate presence with somebody else's story, and really being open to allowing them to tell their story, to explore it in many different ways, and just to be with them. I think that's the most significant. I mean, there's lots of techniques and tools and creative things that we can do, and I sometimes give homework, but I always tell them it's not school, so if you don't do it, it's fine, you know. And I might make a suggestion that doesn't resonate with them, and that's fine also, because it's really about them. So when I take that stance of being open in compassionate presence with a grieving person, then I can meet them where they are and allow them to find their own way, their own path through it.
And have you found, and I'm sure this is probably true because I know this is somewhat in my work as well, is that some people do great benefits from groups?
I don't do groups. I mean, I did groups when I was in hospice, so I can't really speak to that because I have not been focused on creating groups. So I think some people are helped by groups. There are some around in the local area that I might suggest to people if that's what they want, but I don't do them myself.
Got
I mean,
it.
I do
okay.
workshops, and in that situation, you know, that's a different dynamic kind of situation.
Got it. And do you have any of those coming up, Claudia?
I don't right now. It's
okay.
been kind of a sparse year for me because I've been grieving myself, and so I've needed it to be kind of a little bit loose. So, but I'm hoping that it'll ramp up going forward. And that information, that will be on my website.
That's great. Well, you know, everything, as they say, in its time, and thus navigating the seasons.
Yes.
So,
it's true.
It's true because, you know, any time you do, first of all, grief stuff, is, I don't have to tell you, is extremely emotional. Extremely emotional. And sometimes in that emotional state, we can't do a lot. Sometimes you can just, you know, sit, have a cup of tea and, you know, doze off and whatever, because it can be overwhelming and it can be so deep that we don't know how to, quite honestly, move ourselves from, you know, from one place to the other. And I would have to say, without assuming here, I would have to say that that's probably one of the things that is difficult about the winter months or losing somebody pre-winter months or in winter months.
Right.
So,
Suzanne, I last week I actually spoke to a group of one of the senior organizations locally here in Hillsdale, New York, and they asked me, they actually, when they hired me, they said, we don't want you to talk about grief or death. We want you to come and talk about seasonal affective disorder. So I did. I went in and I talked about, you know, seasonal affective disorder, which where some people feel very depressed in the winter and they have difficulty getting out of bed. And, you know, it's a real thing.
Right.
In a diagnosable sense, it's really only about 5%. But if you already have some form of clinical depression, it can ramp up to being about 30% of people who experience seasonal depression. And there are tools that you can use, like lamps and getting out in the sun and other things. So I talked about that. But then I said, you know, winter is a time that of darkness, of, you know, going inward. And why is that such a bad thing? If we could look at it more creatively and we could remember that deep under the ground in the dead of winter, the bulbs and the seeds are actually stirring and bursting forth underneath where they're struggling to come up through the frozen ground. And now that it's starting to become spring, we're starting to see the shoots. But all that happened in the middle of the winter. And also when you think about an incubation period, like, or a gestational period when somebody is pregnant, it takes 9 months for that to grow. And then there's also the second phase of incubation after the baby is born, that maturation process early on. So we don't always have to look at darkness as being something terrible. It's definitely a time to be inside, to do a lot of journaling, to, you know, do some craft, to drink soup and risotto, you know, have comforting foods. But it also could be a time for seeding what you would like to grow in the spring of your life. So it's just a different way of looking at it. And I think that, you know, yes, I agree that some people get very depressed and feel badly when there's not a lot of light. But there's also a way to approach that creatively as a natural process, a natural flow.
I kind of agree with you, too. And I think that, I mean, obviously all seasons have their power. All of them have their strength. All of them have their, you know, their wonderfulness. But there is something too in wintertime where you can be in those moments that, you know, you do, you can't, I mean, ultimately you can't escape it. I mean, you have to at some point address it or deal with it and you got to go through it on, you know, on some level. Everybody has to go through it on some level. And sometimes,
right. And there's also something else, which is that we just have to be with it, even though it's very uncomfortable.
Right.
When you can't get out of bed because you just feel so bad or you're grieving so hard and you just can't see your way forward, if you just allow yourself to relax into that and be with it and say, you know, maybe in an hour I'll feel better. Or if I don't feel better in an hour, then maybe, you know, maybe in 2 hours I'll feel better. Maybe I'll get up and I'll have some tea and then go back and lie down. And tomorrow might be a better day. So, you know, there's a way to get through it and to allow yourself to feel those emotions and be with them, as messy as they might be. You know, that's part of the process, too. We can't fix it. We have a strong desire to want to fix it, and we have a strong desire for it to be over and done with. I mean, I'm feeling that now myself. You know, I'd like this grief process to be finished, and I know that it can't be, that I have to go through it, and I have to take the time, all the time that it takes to find my way to how my life is going to unfold. And it's not easy to sit with that discomfort, but that is part of the process.
It's mostly definitely part of the program. So in saying that, how different is this the second time than the first time of your first husband's loss?
It's quite different, and you know, it is very different, and it's different for so many reasons. I mean, for one thing, my husband was just 50 when he died. We were in the middle of our lives. We had our oldest child was in college, the second child was in high school, and the third one was in middle school. And so I was really in the middle of life, and I was, you know, I didn't plan on being a single parent. You know, it was very shocking. He died of a heart attack, so it was very shocking. And I had the feeling, like I had mentioned, of feeling shattered and really trying to repair my life. You know, this time around, having made the choice to repartner and marry again, knowing that it was a pretty strong likelihood that I would be widowed again, this time my children are all grown. They have, some of them have children of their own, and they came to support me, to make sure that I was okay, to say goodbye to him. And it's very different. I mean, back then I didn't have a really viable career that could support me, and now I do have something that I'm very passionate about and engaged with. So that kind of feeling of what am I going to do with my life, that doesn't exist now. It's sort of more like what will I do with it in this next phase of my life because I'm older now. I'm more financially comfortable as well. So, you know, there's a lot of different aspects to it. And it was a very different relationship. You know, I mean, I met my first husband when I was in my 20s, and we grew up together, you know, for 25 years. And to meet somebody, you know, later on when I'm in my mid-50s and, you know, without knowing him before, not having all that, you know, information and the family relationships that, you know, we had developed in my previous marriage, you know, it was very different. And also because I'm a thanatologist and because I'm a grief counselor, I know a lot more about the grieving process. I know myself more, how I navigate through it. And I also have the colleagues to help. You know, I could call up the person who started the first end-of-life doula program and say to him, Henry, I need your help. Can you find me a doula? And he did. You know, I can call up my colleagues like Bob Niemeyer or Sharon Strauss and say, you know, can you help me? Heather Stang, who you met at Omega, can you help me, you know, just talk to me, do a session with me because I needed help. So I had a lot more professional support this time around than
That's great. Well, support is, you can't ever knock it.
Yeah.
It's quite wonderful.
Yeah, and I have to also say that I had, both times I had the most amazing family support. My siblings and my brother-in-law and you know, just my family just really helped bolster me through the whole thing. My friends, they're very important to me.
Well, they are our gold, as they say. They are our gold.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
they are.
And there's nothing like that goal to have in your life because I'll tell you, it's a quite wonderful thing. And I probably, like you, meet a lot of people who don't have that. And that adds a whole other level of loss to your life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you're already in grief and loss, and then it's like you don't have people to be there with you, or that you could, like you said, you can call and you feel totally kind of alone in it, and so you have to make the incentive to try to reach out to different avenues and things of that sort. So
that's true.
That's kind of a whole other thing. Well, this has been great, Claudia. Thank you so much. Again, the book for everybody is Navigating the Seasons of Grief with grief counselor and author Claudia Conan. And we don't want to forget the coronaproject.com, which is www.thecoronaproject.com. So this has been great, Claudia. Thank you very much, and the best to you, and enjoy spring coming up. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Suzanne. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. And as always, everybody, another great thing I'm going to just mention again here, spring, it's around the corner, and we were talking about being outside. I think it's time to get the digging, you know, tools out and go and do it. So as always, I hope that everything you want may be yours, and enjoy the spring coming up, guys. And catch me out in one of my couple of my events that are coming up, in a small group on the 11th of this month, and the gallery on the 21st. And as always, I hope that everything you want may be yours. Hello? Okay. I was working, and I'm going to be going back to work. What's going on? Can we talk? Okay. So I'll call you back in a bit. Okay. Bye.
Downstairs, he was talking. I heard the conductor, and then I see all these lights.
Very hard for the money.
So, you know, I don't think we're anything.
Oh, I don't either.